Thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings from Faith Radio. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Faith Radio Mornings here on the 7th of November. This is the show here as part of the Faith Radio Network, where we cover a lot of the news and some of the important topics of the day, not necessarily from the perspective of a Fox News or a CNN, though we certainly will have some of those perspectives. But most importantly, we will claim our allegiance again this morning to the eternal kingdom of God, and we fix our eyes on Jesus as we walk out life together, the author and perfecter of our faith, and that is what will inform our conversations today. I'm your host for the show, Dr. Peter Kapsner, joined in studio by Rachel Sutton, who's running the sound and the board, as well as Paul Perot, who does such a great job bringing the news to just stacks of news to my desk every morning, and they bring great guests from around the country on this. And Rachel, my understanding is that this was the first midterm election that you ever had a chance to vote in.
It was.
So how did it go yesterday? You showed up, and I understand that you took the advice of Nicole Phillips, who is a regular contributor to our program here, where she said yesterday, just bring some kindness into all this division. Maybe show up with some food to share as we wait in line.
Yeah. So actually yesterday I had posted to my own Facebook and said, hey, I dare you guys, just try this. And I got a lot of people who were saying, that's a great idea. You know, I didn't get any stories so far, but I did take some brownie bites and some apples along with me. There wasn't a big line at my polling place, so I just gave it to the people who worked there, but they were happy about that. So
yeah, outstanding. I was mindful of the polling people when we showed up last night as well, that it had been a long day, and they still, we got to the polls when they closed about a half an hour before they closed, and still they had a smile on their face and so gracious to just point us all the different directions to go where we can get the voting done.
Yeah, and they recognize it's important, and they're there to serve, so it was great to talk with them and just have some smiles in the midst of a polarized day.
Absolutely. So to all of you listening this morning that participated in a volunteer basis to help get all of this voting done yesterday, we're very grateful at Faith Radio Mornings for the work and the graciousness that you provided for all of us yesterday. I'm assuming some of you took advantage of the free pizza that was available for the longer lines that were out there as well, but it was quite a morning. Glad that it's in the rearview mirror at this point. And coming up here on Faith Radio Mornings, we're certainly going to bring the best that we know into the program to do some analysis of what we saw yesterday and what we see into the future. So I see that Adam Carrington, who is a regular contributor to the show, is already on the line. We'll take a short break here early, and then we'll be joined by Adam Carrington and get his perspective on what we saw last night as well as what we can anticipate here into the future. So welcome to Faith Radio Mornings. Faith Radio Mornings here at about 8 minutes past the hour on the 7th of November, and that means we are one day removed from the midterm elections that we've seemed to be talking about forever. And because that's true, we want to bring Adam Carrington back onto the show. He graciously has agreed to join us. He is probably the voice here on Faith Radio Mornings, helping us understand so many of the different dimensions of the political world. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning. I would thought by today you all would want a break from me, given that it's finally the election's over.
Well, you know, I'm just guessing, Adam, that maybe this isn't the end of the political conversation.
No. I think the only time it really ends is if you no longer are a citizen, or if you wake up and there's a tyranny. And I think that means that to the degree that we get sick of the ads, we get sick of the fighting and debating, and of course we can talk about better and worse ways to do it. I've never gotten too mad that people ask me for my vote, given the alternative.
Absolutely. It is one of those incredible freedoms that we have when you think about the headlines around the world and so many people either voting in elections that really are sort of false or propped up elections or no election at all. So as you're watching last night, Adam, I don't know how much you took in the coverage of different things, but what were some of your initial reactions to the fact that the Democrats took over control of the House, the Republicans look poised to expand their majority in the Senate? How did you process all of this?
Well, two broad things I'd say. That on one hand, it didn't go as well as some of the Democrats had hoped, certainly not in the Senate. But in some ways, if you look at some of the models that some of the guys like 538 or Cook Political Reports, if some people follow those, it went fairly closely overall to those. The idea that the GOP would pick up some seats, the Democrats would pick up in the low to mid 30s in the House. So while there were some particular upsets, I think Florida was a bit of a surprise to me, as was how big the difference was in Indiana. In some ways, this played pretty close to what a lot of people that weren't too partisanly invested predicted. The other thing is that you sort of see that the 2016 map, I think, is now the new map. And I think Minnesota 8, that the 8th district where you all are, was an example of that, that rural blue-collar districts are going more and more Republican, and where Democrats made a lot of their gains are typically more what used to be more Republican suburbs. Republicans really got clobbered in the suburbs and did better and better in states with large rural populations. And I think that's just 2016 continuing to work itself out.
Well, and it's fascinating too, Adam. And is there something about the governorships where they're allowed to draw up different kind of district lines? And is that part of the gerrymandering process that we might see where, you know, certain districts will get herded together a bit and that might make a difference in elections moving forward?
It will. This election for governor, where most of the governorships were up, and then 2020 for the state legislatures will really determine a lot of the gerrymandering or redistricting. And that's why Republicans doing as well as they did in 2010 and was such a big deal. They won so many governorships and legislatures that they were able to draw the lines. So that will make, I think, a significant difference going forward and for the 2020 election. I wouldn't put it past the importance that Republicans won Florida for them trying to keep Florida. I wouldn't put it past the fact that the Democrats won Michigan for the idea that puts Michigan more in play for them. Having the governorship matters a great deal for statewide power.
When I think watching some of these different races in the states you describe, it seems like it's pretty representative of where we are as a country. I don't know about you, Adam, but I know the last 2 years, the narrative coming from the Democratic side of things is that the 2016 presidential results were a big mistake, that there was an election stealing that happened. It must have been Russia. This doesn't make any sense of America. And now we see maybe the highest voting turnout of all time at a midterm election. And here we are, where there's a pretty evenly divided country and nobody's claiming that anybody stole anything.
No, and I think what it means is that we are a divided country. We don't know quite what direction we definitively want to go. And I think another thing to say that 2016 wasn't an anomaly as far as how people are changing their votes. There was some research already done about the vote percentages by county in places like Florida, Wisconsin, other places, and how they correlated to 2016. And that basically it was almost identical. How regions voted in 2016 was almost the exact way they voted in 2018, with just some small differences in certain places. So we're in for more of the same in a certain sense, given that setup.
And it looks like a bit, maybe one of the differences that we'll note is that the House of Representatives is now in control of the Democrats. And certainly we're seeing Nancy Pelosi kind of ascend back into power, at least in her own mind.
Today is more than about Democrats and Republicans. It's about restoring the Constitution's checks and balances to the Trump administration.
So is Pelosi signaling, first of all, that she thinks she's going to be Speaker of the House again? And I would love to get your take on that, because there's at least some potential other routes in which the Democrats might go. But secondly, is she signaling the agenda that might be the next 2 years for the Democrats in which they're going to obstruct the president?
I do think the speaker question is going to be very interesting, because there were a number of Democrats that ran on the platform that if they won, they wouldn't support Pelosi for speaker. In the end, I think she will end up being speaker because there'll be a desire to just coalesce and have a united front. Although if there's any sort of breakdown or problems going forward, I could see there being a revolt down the road in the next 2 years. On the other side, yeah, I think, you know, anytime you win, you often talk about bipartisanship. But I think the real agenda is going to be that they believe they're going to be a thwart to President Trump, and that they're going to be trying to set up 2020 in a way that they can try to take the Senate and the White House. So I think you're going to see more battles, more difficulties, more fighting from here on out.
And from your perspective, Adam, what tends to play itself out better in future elections, the pathway they could take as control in control of the House, where they are obstructing the president, where they're resisting, where Pelosi says things like she did say yesterday, that Democrats must be ready to take a punch and to throw a punch and go the resist side of it? Or is it better for them in 2020 to maybe work on some legislative items such as immigration and the opioid crisis, some of these sorts of things? Do you have a sense historically what's a better pathway for future elections?
I think the better pathway is to push issues, not personality. And that's going to be really hard given the current climate, because so much of it is the personality of the president and the personality of the people that don't like him or oppose him. But I think where Democrats were most successful was not talking about impeachment, not talking about calling Trump names, which was what a lot of people inside the Beltway were doing. But I think the more effective thing was talking about health care, talking about education. So if I was the Democrats, I would put forward legislation that really emphasized those issues, and then see what happens next, and then see if you can then build a distinction that people would want to vote for you, not just against someone else.
I'm talking with Adam Carrington this morning, who's a professor of politics at Hillsdale College and regular contributor to the show. He sort of handles all of our main political conversations and is joining us again this week. Adam, we'll take a short break. And when we come back from break, I would love to get your take on what the Republican control of the Senate is going to mean moving forward, as well as the potential rising star in the Democratic Party, that being a Senate candidate out of Texas. So we'll talk with Adam Carrington more about the results yesterday in the 2018 midterms next on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Kapsner, joined in the line by Dr. Adam Carrington. We are reviewing the results of the 2018 midterms yesterday. Now, Adam, is my understanding correct that you are actually calling us from an Uber right now?
Well, Uber, and then I got dropped off at the airport. So my flight got changed up, so I apologize for any background noise.
No. We are mostly concerned because, Adam, don't you normally roll with a limo, a guy of your stature?
Oh, of course. You know, I only do the best, and, you know, my background shows that I'm really that that full of myself. Yes. Actually, the interesting thing is I'm actually in Washington, D.C. So I was sort of imbibing. I've never been here on election day.
So what was it like last night? Where were you, where did you find yourself, and what was the coverage like in that part of time? I mean, you're at ground zero at that point.
Right. Well, in some ways, it was a little quieter than I expected because so many people are out in their districts, out for their elections. At the same time, I think there was a bit of a buzz. I was on Georgetown Law's campus giving a talk, and I think there was sort of a sense of because of the surprises of 2016, I think everyone was a little bit on edge either way, regardless of which side they were on. I'll be interested what kind of conversations I hear in the airport now that the results have come back.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see with the level of turnout that happened yesterday. Certainly people seem to be more engaged in the political process than maybe we've seen in quite some time.
Yes, and I think that's a good thing. I think that it's good that people felt engaged, that they felt it mattered. And I think that you even saw this. And, you know, and there might be some debate about the particular issues, but there are even some ballot initiatives in Florida and in my home state of Michigan
that were asking about ways to make voting easier or ways to make, you know, if people have been convicted of a crime that wasn't particularly violent, should they be banned from voting? And a lot of those things were also voted on in the direction of greater participation, which I think in general is a good thing. I think there can be and should be some exceptions. But, you know, again, what we said before the break, I think it's a very good thing that people want to participate in popular government. If we're going to have a government of, by, and for the people, then the people have to be part of it.
It certainly seems like the House control of the Democrats and the expanding control of the Senate by the Republicans, with so many people coming out to vote, does represent the will of the people in some interesting ways. And what do we see moving forward? We talked about the House a bit, Adam, but for the Senate, with expanded control of the Republicans, what can they actually do from a legal standpoint? It sounds like maybe they can continue to appoint judges and a few other things.
That would be the thing. I was going to say judges. They now have a lot more space to nominate more who the president wants. You're not worried about just one or two people. If one or two people decide they don't want to, if, you know, if Susan Collins from Maine doesn't like the nominee, that's not as big a deal now. So I think you're going to see more judges appointed. I think if you see another vacancy on the Supreme Court, it'll be a lot easier to get the candidate through. And that's going to be the number one thing. That's one of the biggest things that the Senate does, independent of even the House. As far as other major legislation, I'm not convinced with the split that you're going to see other major legislation going through. It's going to mainly be judges, I think, going forward.
And for the president, if he wants to enact any sort of legislative agenda, is he sort of reduced down on some levels to executive orders at this point?
That will be the temptation. And I think that's a temptation that the president, having been a CEO, is already prone to, that he likes to act unilaterally if he can. And I think that having a Democratic House will be more of I don't want to say an excuse, but more of a reason for him to believe that that's what he should do. And that's going to test things, because here's going to be the interesting thing. You're going to get a lot of people who under the Obama era said, I don't like executive orders. I don't like presidents acting unilaterally. But the question is going to be, what happens when a president does something you like unilaterally through executive orders? What happens when it's an end you like, but not the means to get there that you think is right? And I think the people that are really wanting to uphold the Constitution are going to say, at times, right purpose, wrong way to get there. And I think that's something that we're going to have to watch with how expansive executive power becomes, and whether Congress can then step up and do its job so that you can get the right thing done the right way.
Talking with Adam Carrington this morning. He is at an airport in Washington, D.C. about the election results. And Adam, we have a couple minutes left. One of the other sort of notes now is, of course, the polls have closed, which means that everybody's already beginning to look towards the 2020 election cycle. And quite a bit of the response to Beto O'Rourke, the senator candidate out of New York, to his loss to Senator Ted Cruz yesterday, was that he's the rising star in the Democratic political party and positioning for 2020. And he took an interesting conciliatory tone yesterday.
All this bitterness that defines so much of the national conversation today, if there's anything that we can do to help him in his position of public trust to ensure that Texas helps to lead this country.
Little surprised that he threw his support behind Senator Cruz at least a little bit yesterday. Interesting message out of the Senator O'Rourke.
Right. And at least if I'm not going to be too cynical, though that's often hard in what I do. hopefully what it means is that you believe that elections declare the will of the people, and once it's declared for the public good, you get behind the other guy. A great example of this was when back in 1860, when Stephen Douglas lost to Abraham Lincoln, which he had never done before. He had run before in 1858 against him in the Senate and won. He immediately supported him wholeheartedly in the midst of the Civil War coming. And I think that hopefully that's the good point. But yes, there is talk that Beto will go national now. And, you know, he did lose by less than I expected. But it also is a little bit hard to say to build a national platform on I lost close. So that's going to be a very interesting, you know, how is he able to explain or frame the election result last night as to whether he has much of a future?
Well, and certainly we saw some rumblings already out of Senator Joe Biden as well as Hillary Clinton. And I suppose we expect some announcements from them now within the next couple of months.
Yeah, I mean, Clinton, I would be very surprised. Biden, the question is going to be age. I think the Democrats would probably be better served to get a younger generational figure. Who that would be, I think, is a big question. Would it be Kamala Harris? Would it be Beto? Would it be others? But that kind of thing is why you have primaries. And I think it's going to be a very crowded primary. And I think it's going to be a generational battle, a little similar to what we saw in the Republican Party on what's the future of the party with two very different courses. I think Hillary Clinton versus Bernie Sanders was just a preview. I think it'll be similar and maybe even more intense next time between the Democratic rivals.
Well, Adam, thanks as always for taking the time to join us, especially as you're in the middle of a travel morning in Washington, D.C. And I suppose what I learned from you this morning is the best time to take my kids to the Smithsonian is on Election Day because it's pretty quiet in Washington, D.C.
It is. At least as quiet as D.C. can be. But no, it's beautiful to be here, like I said, in the middle of an election. So anyway, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Safe travels, Adam, and look forward to catching up with you next week.
Great. Look forward to it, too.
Take a break here for Lighten Up and Bottom of the Hour News. And when we come back for the second half of this hour, we'll continue the political conversation. We'll be joined by Dr. Hunter Baker out of Union University in Jackson, Tennessee. And we'll take a few other directions on this as we continue to cover the election cycle this morning on Faith Radio Mornings. Well, as the different headlines continue to come in around the election cycle yesterday, we see that in Nevada that a dead man has been elected to the Nevada State Assembly. Famed brothel owner of all things, Dennis Hoff, was running as a Trump Republican when he unexpectedly died last month following a party for his 72nd birthday. It was too late to remove his name from the ballot, so the county clerk's office posted notices at all the polling places alerting voters that the candidate was indeed dead. But Hoff still managed to beat his Democratic opponent Tuesday by, get this, a 70% vote. The Board of County Commissioners will replace Hoff with another member of his party. From the headlines, you can't make it up. A dead man was elected to office in Nevada. Yesterday on Faith Radio Mornings, we were joined by Dr. Jonathan Den Hartog, who is the chair of the History Department here at the University of Northwestern St. Paul. And he was talking a bit about how we can work together in our differences.
I do think that the greater issue, I mean, there are political issues around nationalism, about how the country should operate, about norms in politics. But I do think the bigger question is, how do we show respect for those people we differ with? And do people that we differ with deserve respect? And I feel like more and more that point is breaking down, that rather than talking to people that we disagree with, we just label them and therefore justify dehumanizing. So I think that's one of the more dangerous dynamics in our system today.
Good conversation with Dr. Den Hartog yesterday, just talking about, from a historical perspective, these times of division and rancor that we've had and how we can continue to come back together in the midst of our differences. If you want to catch that entire conversation, you can head to myfaithradio.com and just search our Facebook page and you'll see all of what we had for the program yesterday. A great 16 minutes with him as well. Well, I see that on the line, we're already joined by Dr. Hunter Baker, who is the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Union University, as well as an Associate Professor of Political Science. And we're going to continue the conversation about the election results. And I'll ask Hunter about the impact that Taylor Swift had on his neck of the woods in Tennessee on the election results.
Is there such a thing as healthy fear? In one respect, definitely yes. This is Jim Garland. A healthy fear of God, a reverence, if you will, should be the epicenter of your life, something that will hold you firmly. If I could give you any gift, if I could give our nation any gift today, it would be that. One of the two criminals crucified next to Jesus, as chronicled in Luke 23:32, understood it well. He asked the other criminal, "Don't you fear God?" With the utterance of those few words, this man revealed a heart that had been transformed by God from within by the Holy Spirit. And Jesus promised him, "Today you will be with me in paradise." With such fear, God is well pleased. Pray our leaders would gain a healthy dose of it, and that we would too. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings, here about 21 minutes before the top of the hour, and we are being joined by Dr. Hunter Baker, who is the Dean of College of Arts and Sciences at Union University, as well as the Associate Professor of Political Science. And good morning, Dr. Baker. I'm curious your take on Taylor Swift's impact in your neck of the woods in Tennessee.
Taylor Swift did not have a big impact here in Tennessee. That was kind of a blowout election. Actually, she endorsed Bredesen, and he came in with 43.9%. And that was after polling that actually showed him in the lead for much of the summer. Tennessee is thought of as a red state, and it is. But Bredesen was the not too distant past, was a very popular Democrat governor in the state.
So do you think it was counterproductive on some level, this big endorsement? I mean, clearly she has a following among young people, but in your sense of things, are people getting weary of trying to have Hollywood demand the kind of candidates that they want?
I think that Taylor Swift, you know, she has been much criticized for staying out of politics. She has really been one of the celebrities who has avoided weighing in on the president or any political races, and I think she finally just kind of yielded to the pressure and did the conventional thing, which was to endorse the Democrat. But do these things matter? Do the celebrity endorsements matter? I doubt it. I mean, I think that people kind of break up that People magazine world with the political world. And I don't think that many people make their decision to vote based on what a celebrity thinks.
Yeah, certainly the celebrities do seem to think they have quite a bit of influence, and they are throwing their support around another candidate, thinking ahead to 2020 now, that being the failed senator candidate out of Texas, Beto O'Rourke, but had quite a bit of a following. Even Reuters said yesterday that win or lose, he wins. And I saw you tweeting about some of these things last night, just following that election over in Texas. What was your take on the end result?
I actually lived in Texas for several years. I'll say this, Beto O'Rourke did much better than I thought he could. He lost by not all that much, and that is a deep red state. If you look at O'Rourke, he lost by just about 2 to 3 percentage points. And yet if we go over to the race in the governor's office, the Republican won by a much larger margin there. So clearly O'Rourke outperformed anything that anybody could have expected. And, you know, my understanding is that he raised something like $70 million just in that last quarter for that election. So he did extremely well. Now, can I imagine somebody with a failed Senate bid running for president like some have suggested? Not really. He did well, but this is not, if he would have won, he would have been very much like Barack Obama after Obama won his Illinois Senate race, which, by the way, is a much smaller feat than a Democrat winning in Texas. But it didn't happen. So, I think that O'Rourke will just be looking for his next move in Texas politics.
Yeah, certainly it was the most expensive Senate race considered of all time in terms of the money he raised. He had a lot of money pouring in from outside of the state of Texas itself. Is this getting to be a more common theme, Dr. Baker, where money is coming in from all parts of the United States to maybe help influence a given state's race?
Yeah, that is common, especially in high-profile races. I have to say that as I was looking at this election, if I could have picked the single place where Democrats could do the most damage, I would have said it would be defeating Ted Cruz in Texas, because that would be a sign that things are really changing, that that the anti-Trump sentiment is so powerful that even Ted Cruz can go down. but it didn't happen.
Well, and I think that's going to be part of the national narrative moving forward is watching it the last couple of years. I don't know what your take was on it, but there was a sense in which that in 2016, it was sort of this mistake election. Nobody really saw it coming. It didn't represent the will of the people. It had to be Russian meddling or something else that took place. But we had historic turnout levels last night, and we ended up with a divided Congress and hardly a blue wave. So it does seem like this is pretty representative of where we are as a nation right now.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, it's really interesting, the turnout. In midterm elections, the Republicans tend to have a natural built-in advantage because Republicans tend to vote at higher levels in midterms than Democrats do. So when I heard that we were looking at historic turnout, and, you know, and a lot of my friends, we wondered if that meant that there's a blue wave, right? Because the higher turnout, you would more logically assume, well, that's the Democrats. But it turns out that it was more turnout by everybody. And Donald Trump's coalition proved to be much less fragile than I think a lot of us thought it was.
I had the same thought last night when I was seeing the turnout levels. Exactly what you mentioned is that it's going to really tip towards the Democratic side, and especially when they're talking about the turnout among young people. Do we have any numbers coming in yet in terms of demographically the millennial vote or anything, who they supported? Because I think there's an assumption, right, Dr. Baker, that all millennials, at least most of them, are going to support the Democratic candidate.
Yeah, that's not only, you know, not only with the millennials, but I think that generally speaking, younger people tend to vote more Democrat. I think that went the other way a little bit back when I was a young person. When Reagan was president, he had a lot of support of young people. But no, I haven't seen the numbers this time. But I'm pretty sure that when everything is said and done, you're going to see that millennials did vote for Democrats. I'm sure that young people are a huge reason why Beto O'Rourke did as well as he did. I think they'll be like most voters are over their lifetime, that they'll start Democrat, that as they have families, as they have kids, and they're dealing with school questions and how to pay the bill questions and dealing with questions of taxes and regulation if they're business people, sometimes that moves people over to the Republican side.
We're talking with Dr. Hunter Baker this morning, who is the Dean of College of Arts and Sciences at Union University in Tennessee, also Associate Professor of Political Science. And Dr. Baker, when we come back from break, I would love to tap into that a little bit more about how people do tend to change their voting habits over the course of a lifetime and what that might mean for our country moving forward. So more to come with Dr. Baker next on Faith Radio Mornings. Welcome back to Faith Radio Mornings. Here on the 7th of November, we are covering some of the election results from yesterday with first Adam Carrington of Hillsdale this morning, and now joined in the line by Dr. Hunter Baker, who's the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Union University. And Dr. Baker, before the break, we were talking a little bit, and you referenced the idea that people's voting habits can tend to change over the course of a lifetime. And during the break, I was talking with Rachel Sutton, one of our producers here this morning. She's 22, and she mentioned that most of her friends would vote Democratic right now, except for a small pool of her friends that are Christians that tend to vote Republican. Is this kind of what we see here in terms of the demographic breakdown?
Yeah, I think that's basically true. You know, I know that probably a lot of there was a get out the vote effort directed toward my school, and I'm sure it was directed toward a lot of other Christian schools, and by a conservative group. And I think that their instinct was that if you could turn out kids at colleges like ours, that would be positive for Republicans, and I suspect that that's the case. I mean, Union University is a conservative school, not as conservative as somewhere like Liberty University, more conservative than a Christian school like Baylor. And when we did a straw poll back in 2016. Actually, the overwhelming winner on our campus was Marco Rubio. So that gives you a sense roughly of kind of where the student body is at a place like this.
Well, and how much does faith play into the vote as well? I know that you released a book in 2009 called The End of Secularism, where you're exploring the impact of secularism on sort of social harmony and politics and all of that. And some of the trends suggest that the United States is becoming more secular, some less so. But as a nation becomes more secularized, does it tend to vote in more liberal fashion?
Well, it gives voters a much more stark choice. There's a lot of writing, places like Christianity Today and some other Christian outlets that are just sort of continually horrified that Christians vote for Trump or for the Trump Republican Party. And I think that what they fail to really understand is that whether we want it to be this way or not, the Democratic Party is becoming more and more secular. That outside of maybe the coalition of African Americans and other minorities who tend to vote Democrat, white Democrats are trending much, much more secular over time. And so there tends to be this desire on the part of the left to infringe on things that we would think of as religious liberty, to maybe threaten some of the Christian charitable and educational institutions, as we've seen in California, is nearly the case that all of the California Christian colleges lost important state grants that help low-income students. And of course, there's the life issue, right, where it's very stark. I mean, at one time, there were a fair number of pro-life Democrats in prominent offices, but that's really not the case anymore. I mean, I can't think of any prominent pro-life Democrats at all at the national level. And so when you break it down that way, the choice is fairly stark.
Yeah, it certainly does seem to be the increasingly divided position by position on these things. And Dr. Baker, as you describe sort of becoming more liberal and more secular, and especially some of the white Democrats, laws are they tend to be founded at least on some sort of moral principle that tends to be then founded on some sort of faith tradition. How are laws even made by a party or a political party when there isn't a religious tradition underpinning it?
Well, they tell themselves that their conclusions are basically the result of the use of scientific reason. That essentially, they have grown beyond what they would call superstition, and that through the use of their reason, they are able to apprehend what would be optimal for human beings, and through either the use of technology or enlightened policy, and that we can shape human beings to be better. That's one of the big divides is whether or not you believe in something like original sin, whether or not you believe human beings are fallen. People who are more progressive tend to have the idea that human beings are perfectible, and that we can mold them and shape them, and through education, through a combination of education, policy, and technology, we can make this world perfect.
Is this part of the critique that we're seeing right now among a lot of people in sort of flyover country in our country, that the liberal elite that have been the most educated and the most exposed to some of these different ideas, believing humans can be perfectible, are really saying, hey, we know what's best for everybody else. You need to listen to us.
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. I mean, a lot of people resent that. Or let's just say they don't trust it, right? That doesn't go along with what they believe, and that's why you had huge controversies in the past over things like sex education, right? I mean that liberals believed and still do that at a fairly early age you need to teach children everything about sex and in a very sort of open manner. That your gender could be wide open to determination by yourself. That when you start engaging in sexual activity is entirely up to you. That it's good for you to do that even as a teenager, as long as you use birth control and protection from STDs. Those sorts of things. And so that's a very typical sort of example, right? That would be the way somebody on the left would typically think, and somebody on the right would be horrified by that. They would think that children really don't have their full agency and reason, that they're not really well adjusted to deal with sex and its consequences, and besides which they believe sex is for marriage.
Yeah, it really does. You're articulating well. It seems the dividing line in our country right now between these two philosophies. And Dr. Baker, we have about a minute left or so. Given that the House now belongs to the Democrats in terms of they have the control and the Senate is in the control of the Republicans, and you have these dividing philosophies, is it pretty much gridlock, do you see, for the next couple of years as we head towards the presidential election cycle?
Yeah, I think so, which is not a terrible thing. I saw somebody made the quip that gridlock is as close as we get to constitutional government. So there's that. But the other thing is they could cooperate on a couple of things, particularly infrastructure. U.S. infrastructure is in need of updating, and they could maybe cooperate on that.
I'd be curious to see some of those things moving forward. Does it seem like more of a winning issue for the Democrats in the House to try to cooperate with the president on some policy stuff or to resist the president in all things over the next 2 years?
Right now everybody is focusing on turning out their base. People are not really fighting over the middle like they used to. It used to be everybody tried to fight over the middle. So I don't foresee a lot of cooperation other than maybe on that narrow issue.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Baker, thanks so much for joining us with your expertise and insight, kind of perspective on all these different issues. It's a complicated situation, and yet just to sort of understand it on these levels is very helpful for me and for our listeners. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll take a break here, and we'll wrap up the first hour of our show and preview what's coming up next in second hour here on Faith Radio Mornings. Well, thanks to Drs. Adam Carrington and Hunter Baker this morning to join us in the first hour to help us process so much of what we saw yesterday. And I see a note from Paul Perot across my feed here that considering Taylor Swift's record for writing songs for those who break up with her or diss her, I would assume Marsha Blackburn, the senator from Tennessee, will likely be getting a hate song from Miss Swift coming up forward. So I see that Bill English is over there in the green room. We'll have him join us next on Faith Radio Mornings.
Again, thanks for listening to this podcast of Faith Radio Mornings. You can hear other podcasts at myfaithradio.com. Plus, remember, we are listener-supported, so your support makes Faith Radio Mornings and the other programs from Faith Radio possible. Make your gift at myfaithradio.com.